Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, I mean, our goal is to win the division. So, you know, there's a lot of focus on that. And I think we've had kind of an uneven season. That part of it is performance, but part of it is just, you know, the number of injuries that we've had and that adversity that we've faced. So, but I don't look at it as, I'm not sure, you know, if we look ourselves in the whole picture of the National League, I mean, the goal is to win your division, get to the postseason. And given especially the top of our rotation, I think we've got in our bullpen, I think we've got as good a chance as anyone once we get there.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Monday, July the 12th, 2021. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. Well, welcome to the end of the first half edition of the Talking Mets podcast. New guest is going to be joining us in just a little bit. You guys may know him. He's actually got a loose connection to our buddy Frank the Tank. And don't roll your eyes. I know Frank the Tank was a controversial figure here a couple of weeks ago. But Pat Ragazzo, the Mets beat reporter with Sports Illustrated, and he's going to be joining us in just a little bit. Pat does some nice work. You can check him out on Twitter at Ragazzo Report on Twitter. And he's at every ball game. And Pat will get his feelings on the Mets and what he thinks. And pretty busy Sunday, end of the first half, the draft, lots of stuff going on. But look, I'll get into it. I mean, I know the draft is going on. And as I do this show in just a couple hours, you'll have the Home Run Derby. I'll be honest to start out, I am not a big All-Star Game guy. Did I get into the Home Run Derby with Pete Alonso a couple of years ago? Yeah, I'll admit I did. I'm not sure if I'll be watching it, you know, live. I'm probably going to take a step back from the game for a few days because that's what I like to do during the All-Star break. Just like you guys, just like the players, you got to recharge. You got to take a step back and get ready for the stretch drive. It's what we talked about. It's getting to know the team through the first 60 days of the season, then trying to figure out what they need. And over the next couple of weeks, Zach Scott, Sandy Alderson, and company are going to have to figure out what kind of deals they can make to augment this roster. And then it's about going and getting it done. I mean, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical as the Mets go on the road. Then they come home and they have the Braves. So this charge right after the All-Star break starting Friday in Pittsburgh into the trade deadline is your final push before it's, hey, you got to go out and get it done. But really, the sense of urgency starts now on Friday as you need to try to amp it up and bring it to the next level. And hopefully the Mets could do that. I think that's where I'll start as I assess the first half. Because I'm not going to get to, like I said, the All-Star game, all that. You guys want to watch it, I'll have half an eye on it. But love Pete to death, all that stuff. But you know what? Time to take a break from the game and read more about that and take a step back. But when you look at the first half and you look at it as a whole, I think you got to walk away and say to yourself, you know what? Mets are in a pretty good position. I think if I had told you, and let's go and really read off what the situation is here. 17 players at one point on the disabled list, 7-9 opening day starters outside of McCann and Lindor on the DL. Out of the six starting pitchers that we talked about in spring training, three went down with an injury. Peterson, Yamamoto, Lucchesi. You're down to three starters. You had to bring McGill in. So now you got, you know, you're in your 7, 8, 9, Eichhoff, guys like that. You've been diving into those guys probably a little bit more than you liked. the worst offense at times in the league. At one point, they were averaging under 3 runs a game, and that's with a good chunk of those opening day members in the lineup before the replacements. Then you had the replacements for a good 4, 5, 6 weeks. You have your franchise player, as we predicted, Francisco Lindor, adjusting to New York. And that probably lasted a little bit more and was a little bit more of a valley than we even expected. You know, you talk about guys like Piazza and Beltran and the kind of first years they had. I think Lindor's start was rougher than both of those guys. And, you know, we know how those guys had what they had to go to and what they had to endure. So when you look at all of that, the fact that as of today, the Mets are in first place, 4 games up in the loss column, 3.5 ahead of the Phillies. Now, I understand the division came back, you know, played down. Nobody in this division has put any pressure on them. Acuna's out now, so, you know, you see that. When you look at the guys, you know, the teams that are left, you know, can you really see the Braves now investing in this team with Acuna out? Maybe. I'm not sure what they think, but there's a team that lost money. The Phillies were a team, John Middleton, that wasn't, you know, necessarily a shoo-in to sign JT Realmuto. Will they invest in this team? They're hanging around. They're the team I would watch. Their bullpen is kerosene on the fire, but they got a good manager. I know there's some questions about Girardi. I wouldn't count him out. The one team I think that you still have to worry a little bit about, and I know that they've been streaky, are the Nats because of those three big pitchers. If they get Strasburg back healthy, they got Scherzer, they got Corbin, they can match up right there with the Mets, maybe better if they're on. So you have to watch for them. But nobody in this division really at this point, if the Mets do their thing and they continue to inch towards 10 games over and really play their game, then I can't see them losing the division. Now, does that mean that they're going to be in the mix and I'm going to feel good about them? I said they're a tournament team. I've been saying that for weeks. They're a team that nobody's going to want to face because of DeGrom in a short series. 5-game, 7-game, 1-game play and whatever it is. And there's still a chance. We'll see how San Diego and San Francisco play, that maybe the West comes back. And if, God forbid, something wacky happens, you know, the Mets are in a position where, you know, the wild card is an option. But right now, it looks like they're going to have to win the division. They're in a position where they have the ability to, over the last few months, the 2 months, 8, 9 weeks they've been in first place, to figure their stuff out. So I think when you look at everything, Mets are pretty fortunate that they're in the position they're in because nobody played at a high level in division. They were able to survive the replacements and the injuries. And let's also remember what we talked about in the offseason, that this was an historically significant undertaking that this front office took on. New owner November 1st, bam, right into the offseason. One GM, GM is in, GM is gone, had to rehire. They're making hires during the season. They're pivoting. Tons of on-the-fly decision-making. And really the first half MVP, if you really want to talk about one, might be this Mets front office, which there's a lot of guys. And I know that there's report of some of these analytics guys or some of these back-end guys are getting some promotions there. But between some of the diamonds in the rough they found, going out and getting a Kevin Pillar and a Jonathan Villar, using Steve Cohen's money to augment the roster, not just go for the big fish. You know, maybe they lucked into Taiwan Walker, but give them credit for making that deal after the Trevor Bauer sweepstakes went sour. And how lucky is that? I mean, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. But really, the Mets front office has been the real MVP. Putting in analytics and using it to help improve the defense with... Now they're one of the top shifting teams in the league, and they're not only shifting based on where the player hits the ball. There was a, you know, conversation on the broadcast this week and how they're implementing the pitcher's repertoire into that. And as much as you see a hit here or there, and I complained about the shift a couple of months back, I think it was that series in St. Louis where I felt the Mets were never in the right spot, and you saw it burn them a little bit with the Defoe hit, a couple of hits this past weekend, you know, balls that probably should have been, you know, double plays not being caught. I feel, and I'm sure the Mets feel this, that the positioning on defense that they've put out there has helped them more than hurt them. And and whether you believe in the defensive run saved or the little different metrics that are out there, the eyes tell the truth. The Mets seem to be in position more often than not with a lot of balls that when they come off the bat look like base, it's up the middle. There's somebody right there to play it and get an out. And that's helped make a very good pitching staff maybe even better than they should be. So I think the Mets front office has been the star of the first half. Look, the top three starters have been really good. The bullpen has been a savior. You are starting to see my concerns, and I think yesterday's game against the Pirates, an awful loss. I think the worst loss of the season, really, bar none, the worst loss of the season. Because you're ready to end the first half on a high note, All you had to do was put a couple more runs on the board. They were done. And, you know, sure enough, my fear is that they put the five spot up really early. And there was a lot of baseball left and the Mets blew it. But really what you saw is that when you get away from the Diaz, Lugo, Loop, May portion of the bullpen, and May has kind of fallen back and forth, and you rely more on the Familia, Castro, Drew Smith, et cetera, the Eichhoffs of the world, the Tropianos, whoever you want to put out there, you start to see the concerns where a team that's relying on, yesterday, basically 27 outs out of their bullpen, if you want to count Eichhoff as a starter, okay, but, you know, really, it was a bullpen game. This is where the, you know, problems really come into play. Your starters are only really going 6 or 7 innings. You're not really pushing them. They haven't. Maybe they'll start to do that. They're pushing DeGrom a little bit more. You're asking for 9 outs from the bullpen every game. And then you factor in how the offense has not executed. Now, it's starting to heat up a little bit. Since Nimmo came back July 3rd, I saw a stat. They're averaging a little over 5 runs a game. That's more like the offense that we expected. Maybe if that's the norm going forward, then, you know, things will be a little bit different. But the problem is that all the close games, which are definitely character-building situations, are burning out this bullpen. And then when you ask a Castro to go that extra 3 outs, when you ask Familia to go that extra batter or 2 like they've done a couple of times this year, they can't do it. They can't do it. You know, a lot of times with Familia and Castro, you get what you get out of that one inning, and that's it. You got to, you know, fold it. You know, fold it while you're ahead. You know, we'll see if a Drew Smith or a Yency Diaz or if Sean Reed Foley comes back or maybe there's somebody else. We'll see. But right now, that's the main concern, is that as they continue to play these close games, the more reliance you're going to have to be on the whole bullpen and how more of that second tier of the Mets bullpen, which I've been talking about for a few weeks, comes more into play. How can this be a special season? Well, it's really, ironically enough, we're going to make the big assumption they're going to be a lot healthier in the second half than they were in the first half. And I think that's fair enough. I mean, how much worse can the health get? It's really going to depend on the offense, because I think it all starts with the Mets averaging those 5+, I mean, maybe not even 5 a game, maybe 4.5. League average, maybe that's enough. But if they could average 5 or more a game, they're going to be in position where then they can maybe give that second tier of the bullpen some cushion on most days when they could get 5 or 6 innings from the starter. And, you know, they can, you know, potentially then really hone in on when they need the A team to get those final 6 to 9 outs in closer games against better teams and what have you. Can they execute with runners on third in less than 2 outs? They haven't done a lot of that this year. Can they be better situationally? What's their approach? So a lot of times you've heard Luis Rojas talk about their approach. You can watch it while you guys, you know, look, we're all amateur hitting coaches. We're all amateur analysts. I don't care who you are, whether you're in the media or you're with us here. There's plenty of times. I thought it was an at-bat yesterday. I think it was a 3-ball count. Don Smith hit ball to warning track. He swung at ball form saying, you know, kind of situation where the more you put pressure on the pitcher, the more walks you take, the more runners you get on base, the harder it's going to be for these guys to get through these innings. And I think that's what they have to do. What they did in the first inning was perfect. They took their walks. They had a couple big home runs. That's what's going to happen for this team to score, because they have not shown the ability to string through a lot of hits. Now, they did that a little bit against the Yankees. But other than that, they really haven't. They did it on Friday in the 13-run outburst. But even that, there was a ton of walks there. When they're walking, when they're patient, when their approach is good, puts pressure on the opposition, that's when they're at their best. And they haven't done that a lot. And it's critical. It's critical for this team to start to execute with runners on third, opportunities with bases loaded. There's a couple of bases loaded, nobody out situations against Milwaukee this week. Couldn't bring it home. It's a killer. It's an absolute killer when you don't score and you let those teams off the hook. And, you know, they were fortunate. They had a 4-3 homestand. They're probably a game off of where I wanted them to be. I thought 48-39 would have been a nice way to go into the end of the first half. Didn't happen. Now you got to wipe that bad loss away, and you go on the road, and away you go. So what is next other than that? Well, we're going to be sitting back and seeing what can they do to augment this team. What can they do? Is there another bullpen arm? Look at Rodriguez, the Pirates. Guy just throws fastballs and throws strikes. He gets out of the inning. That's it. It's not that, you know, the walks, the drama, the 3-2 counts, the foul, like, just throw strikes. Get me somebody that can throw strikes, please. I don't ask for a lot. I don't, you know, you don't have to have 110 mile an hour stuff. So I think they need to go out. I definitely think they could. They need to see what kind of bullpen arm they could acquire. Those are usually the easiest ones to acquire. There's got to be somebody looking to dump them without asking for a lot there. I mean, look, the Mets traded Familia, Addison Reed when they were sellers. You know, can they find a guy like that to help their bullpen in the last 8 weeks? What are they going to do with the open starting pitching slot? Good news is that Carrasco is going to start his rehab assignment. You know, will he be doing his rehab assignment by doing 2-3-4 inning starts, modified pitching at the big league level? It's very possible. Looks like that's a big possibility. Then maybe the need to trade, you know, becomes a little bit less because do you trust Tyler McGill? I think the thing right now you have to ask yourself with Tyler McGill, who I still think, you know, could be a length guy out of the bullpen, because I don't know. I have to see more as he goes around. I know he's pitched against guys a couple of times, but again, the more that you have these games where you have to go to your AA team and win and burn out your bullpen, I think the worse you're going to be as you get later in the year. You need a healthy, rested, well-run bullpen. It's been a well-run bullpen all year. It's been one of the better managed bullpens in a long, long, long time. Long time, maybe 15 years. So, you know, helping that bullpen be its best by having it rested and not overused may require, can you go out and get a Kyle Gibson? What's that going to cost? Look, you just drafted a stud pitcher. So maybe you feel more comfortable trading a Matt Allen. I know he's hurt. JT Ginn. Maybe you feel better trading from your stable to put your chips really to the center of the table. And do you go in and bring in a Chris Bryant to play third base? Or do you go at a higher end of the market? I mean, it's a possibility. They're really not giving you an indication. You hear a lot of names, but the Mets haven't given you an indication other than what you hear is that they don't want to trade top prospects. But as you get closer to the 31st and as you could smell an opportunity to win, you know, this draft that's ongoing as we speak may allow you with these players you're bringing in to trade similar type of assets that you currently have in the system and go for it. So we'll see. So that's really where I'm at. It's, and I think you heard Zach Scott coming in. Little uneven. I think you could make the argument that they missed the golden opportunity to blow this division out of the water. By rights, they should be very comfortably ahead, and we should be already, you know, a la 2006, be doing the let's get ready, let's round out the roster, let's get ready for the playoffs. But you know, I always say it's like a basketball game. Look at it like a basketball game. Winning a division sometimes over the course of season is like a basketball game. Instead of the ebbs and flows happening over 2.5 hours, it happens over 6 months. And you let a team hang around, a team that clearly isn't playing well, clearly wants to be put away, but the more you let them hang around, whether it's because you're compromised yourself, team's in foul trouble, you have injuries, whatever, the more likely that a run happens. And when that run happens, you better hope they don't get hot. Because last 2 minutes of the ball game, down by two, anybody could hit a three. You could be the worst team in the league. You could be the best team in the league. When those last 2 minutes come in a basketball game, it's all even. They're all pro players. And the same thing I'm going to say for the Nats, for the Braves, for the Phillies. At some point, as we get into August, they're going to look up at the deadline and say, we're 3 games out. We're 4 games out. Why not us? You know, we have a homestand coming up. We go 7-3 on the homestand. The Mets go 4-6. We're tied. You know, very easily. So just because we're not, you know, feel, you know, there's not a buzz around these teams and maybe it's been lackluster because they haven't really put together a run, don't discount them. And the time is to get serious and the Mets have to step up their game. They have to be much better. And I think it starts with the offense and it starts really with the possibility that, hey, the guys that you see out there are the guys that are just going to have to be better. The fact that majority of these guys on offense are below league average going into the All-Star break is mind-boggling, despite some of this trends upward since July 3rd. But, you know, that's where it goes. So that's where we're at, first half. That's my feelings on the first half. We're going to take a quick break. When I return, Luis Rojas, what are my thoughts on him? Because I think he's been a big part of the first half. And we'll talk about that more right after this. The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5 because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at mikesilva@mikesilva.com. TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G. TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon and enjoy the rest of the show.
Louis's great. I mean, he's such a good, genuine person. He's very open-minded. We have really good conversations. I've really enjoyed getting to know him. It's been one of the best parts of the job, is getting to spend so much time with Louis and to get to know him and how much he cares for players. He's an even-keel guy, which is great when you play in a market like this where there's always going to just be organically be pressure. And there's going to be ups and downs because it's baseball. So he handles that really well. And like I said, open-minded, wanting to learn new things, wanting to always get better. And I really appreciate, even though he's a, you know, fairly, comes off as fairly soft-spoken, even killed, he has no problem having difficult conversations. And it's very effective because the players know that he really genuinely cares about them. And I think that goes a long way towards them listening more. So it's been great.
Kids today, like, you grew up with sports, you have your heroes, right? And there's different generations, and all the athletes are different. You know, when you go back and talk to Messier, or look, you know, and he tells stories about the NHL, right? Or Barry Bonds, and in their generation, you know, it was toughness and this and that. Kids today, a 20-year-old, 22-year-old kid is completely different than a 22-year-old was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And relating to them is different. Like somebody was telling me yesterday, actually, it was like there's kids, they have so many inputs and so many distractions, and basketball is just one of them. You know, when we were growing up, if you were into sports, you know, it's like the movie Diner, right? Where he quizzes his girlfriend, right? That was what it was about.
Right.
And that's just not the case anymore. And it used to be, and I used to feel strongly this way, that having an in-games X and O expert gave you the ultimate advantage. But now I think having a relationship person, right? Somebody who can connect to the players, because that's what gets them to go a little bit harder, right? That's what, you know, when the chips are down and every team has a bad run, one way or the other, you want somebody that just is a relationship person. It's not that Rick isn't good at that. He was, but it's just harder to relate to a 22-year-old.
All right, we're back. You know, you guys know who've been listening to this show a long time. I'm not the most touchy-feely guy, but I believe in coaching and leadership and the impact of a manager and the ability of groups to sometimes maximize their talent and do more than the collective total of the group by just being the best version of themselves they could be. Look, I grew up, I've told you a billion times, I'll tell you a billion and one, I'm a disciple of Pat Riley's Knicks. I mean, that to me is the epitome of coaching and leadership and the lessons that that team and that coach imparted on me at a young age. And you could go back and still read about those things in books like The Winner Within, or, you know, listen to a guy like Riley speak. It's going to be with me the rest of my life. But things have changed a lot. And the clips that you heard coming in, you know, first Zach Scott talking about Luis Rojas. And then you heard the clip from Mark Cuban. Now, Mark Cuban, why am I playing Mark Cuban, you ask? Well, that was from Victory the Podcast. Great podcast. It has nothing to do with sports, but Mark Cuban was on there. And he talked about making the change that the Dallas Mavericks made by going from Rick Carlisle to Jason Kidd. And taking the basketball part of it aside, you heard Cuban talk about caring and communication with the players. And I think you, ironically, when I heard that clip, and then I heard the Zach Scott clip, I thought of Luis Rojas, because I've said this a lot, and I go back to how I've talked about where I was when the Mets were going through the managerial search, and it was about a few things. First, you want a manager that can manage up, because now you have to manage up to your bosses. You have to manage that clubhouse game, respect in that clubhouse, hold them accountable. And from my era growing up, that was also a bit of a taskmaster. Like a guy like Pat Riley, Bill Parcells, great coaches from when I was a kid, they were taskmasters. It was my way or the highway. Can't really do that anymore. You have to do that without doing it overtly. You have to manage the media. That's a big part of the job. And then in baseball, it's about managing the bullpen. And when you start to look at Luis Rojas and you hear what Zach Scott said, that not only can he gain the respect of the players and care about them, but he's able to have the tough conversations and hold them accountable. That's the money ball quote to me. Because there's two things that come out of player managers. First of all, there's fake player managers that you know, talk about the players, but don't give you know what about them. And I think to a certain degree, Mickey Callaway fell into that because right away you heard a lot about his inability to spend time and connect and communicate with his players. I think Mickey was more about Mickey. It was more about overly focusing on the media. And I think when Brody Van Wagenen came in after Sandy Alderson left, he had to overly focus on his bosses because there was a disconnect there. And then you have player managers that are so player-centric that they get taken advantage of because they're not strong enough because they build a relationship with the players. They're not strong enough to have those tough conversations and hold them accountable when they do something wrong or bench them or, you know, communicate the message that is maybe not popular. Look, Francisco Lindor said it off the bat. I don't like shifting. He said it early in spring training. He's done it. There was some issues. The famous rat-raccoon fight with McNeil. And it looks like they figured it out. And I'm sure there was a lot of selling of these concepts to a guy that, let's face it, Lindor doesn't need the shift to be a good defensive player. He could probably cover a ton of ground. McNeil might not be able to. VR, whoever the third baseman, might not be able to. It might not be best for the team, but he did it. And you probably got to give Luis Ross some credit being able to sell that message, but also hold him accountable and holding a guy making $34, $35 million a year accountable. So when you look at Luis Rojas, when you hear players, manager, and caring for the players, you think of weakness. You think of how, you know, when I was reading the book, actually doing the audio book of Andy Martino's sign-stealing book about the Astros, one of the quotes from A.J. Hinch really struck me is that leadership sometimes is how much you're going to tolerate. And, you know, a guy like Hinch tolerated too much and actually, I thought, came across weak when it was all said and done. And I don't think Luis Rojas is a weak guy. I think he's a guy that generally cares about his players. He wants to show his players he's in their corner. But he's not in their corner to the point where he will compromise the team, compromise his standing, or be malleable with his belief system and the front office and the team's belief system to accommodate a player. Now, look, you got to partner with your stars. You know, guys like Lindor, you know, maybe even a Pete Alonso who's not at that level. But sometimes you have to realize that, you know, their process, their way of going about things, again, goes back to tolerating a certain amount. And how much do you tolerate comes into play. But you can't argue with the results so far. The players, there's even when there was little burst-ups, the hitting coach scenario, firing Chili Davis, which didn't seem to be popular with the players, the whole rat-raccoon drama. Ross didn't BS the media. So he actually, in two ways to me, he showed the players, hey, I don't really agree with what you did. Is that the way I would handle it? Clean it up now because I'm not tolerating it. And he told the media, hey, I'm not going to lie to you. It's BS. But why are we talking about this? We just won a ball game. He kind of showed you in that instance, the two things that I hold true. Managing your players, hold them accountable, and managing the media. He did it right there. And I think he's pretty much able to, there's a certain amount of treating the media like you're selling them. And, you know, communicating with them honestly and openly. Sometimes you have to do a little bit of both. It's like any other relationship. You know, any kind of relationship you have in sales, in business, the media have to make them feel good. And sometimes you have to whack them down when they get out of control. And you've seen some of the players do that. But Louis's kind of direct with that. He doesn't get, you know, overly nasty. He doesn't get tripped up when he's thinking on his feet. And for the most part, he gives them what they need. But I think it's authentic. I don't think it's like Terry Collins was fake tough. And the media loved Terry Collins because he fed them. And you got to do that to a certain degree. You really can't feed the media anymore. And it's a little easier for Louis on that sense because of the Zoom culture that's been in since he took over with COVID. But, you know, still, when you're on that Zoom and you have questions, let's face it, you can still look dumb. You can still, you know, add fuel to the fire and things like that. So, you know, I can't say enough about Luis Rojas. I think that he's a guy that maybe the Mets lucked into the right choice, especially after reading a little bit about Beltran in that book. You know, Beltran, where, you know, Beltran was a guy that always used to go into his shell when he was a player, especially when he was challenged. And that certainly was a concern that I had, is that here's this guy that was like this as a player, and here we are about 10 years later, he's positioned as that, which is this leader. And I'm sure he would have been great with the players and whatnot, but, you know, managing the media and the perception of what this team is and the distractions, you didn't want to have another Mickey Callaway situation. And I was always pretty pro Callaway because I thought he got a raw deal. He never really was given a fair shake. But looking back, he created not just the stuff off the field, but there was a lot of things that were missing on the field that you're hearing about now. And he was not a good tactician, and he was not good at thinking on his feet. And that's the thing about Rojas. I mean, you really can't screw up a ton X's and O's wise. But managing this bullpen, giving guys the day off, bringing guys in leverage situations, finding the right—I really can't sit back. Now, maybe I could quibble here and there, and I don't know who's hurting, who's not, what the load management requirements are with these players, so I have to take that into consideration. Maybe I could have quibbled yesterday instead of pushing Castro the second inning, bringing Drew Smith. I know he pushed Familia a couple of times, multiple innings when you knew he didn't have it. Got away with it against Arizona earlier this year. Didn't get away with it against the Padres. You know, certainly yesterday was on that bubble. You know, bad pitch floated over the plate. Maybe it would, you know, a little unfair. But to me, I can't quibble with his decisions. The lineup is analytics driven. I think that's more about, you know, communicating that to the players and making sure they're on board with it and that doesn't create any discontent. And the biggest thing is, and this is also going to tie into the front office, how can you get guys like Pilar, VR, J.D. Davis is coming back, Guillerme, you know, guys that probably, especially Pilar and VR, who need at-bats and who've played a lot in their career, not easy to sit for 3-4 days, not get an at-bat or get one AB, then come in and contribute. So there's a lot there. So you got to give him a lot of credit. Pressure cooker, new owner, expectations to win, unforgiving media. Maybe it's helped the Yankees have struggled. Maybe Zoom has helped a little bit. But this was not the first choice. It might not even been the second choice or the third choice. And certainly for me, I wanted a veteran manager. I wanted a Buck Showalter. I wanted a Girardi. I'm still, you know, I'm learning this whole caring for the players and communicating in a different way. It's a different world. It's a different world. So, you know, I'm as guilty as the next person as needing to adapt and adjust. But certainly when you talk about these great communicators or these managers that can balance all the things we talked about and still be solid in a tactical way, the few tactical ways that you still have to lean on in this game, he seems to be checking all the boxes. Maybe I've been saying for years that the Mets need a manager, that they can grow and be their guy for the next 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, 10 years. A guy like Davey Johnson who was here a long time. Now, Terry Collins was here a long time, but he was here way past his expiration date, and he was fortunate to get a pennant, and he was really a caretaker. The team didn't grow. He was a caretaker. He was a benign figure after a very difficult period of managers for the Mets, from Bobby V all the way to Jerry Manuel. And now it's about bringing, you know, I always wanted Wally back, but I thought Wally would do a ton of great things. And somebody said to me, and I don't know if they want to know their name, you know, I had a conversation with someone in the business off the air. He was a big Wally Backman supporter back then. And he said, you know, Lou Ross is a lot like Wally Backman, except he doesn't have the baggage that Wally has off the field. And he didn't play for the 86 Mets. And I'm like, you know, that's fair. That's fair. Grinder, you know, is a guy that's really gone up through the system, knows the system and knows what it takes to compete and win and make your way through the minor leagues and grind it out each and every day. And embraces analytics, and you heard what Zach Scott said, new ideas, and that's important. So if you could manage up, manage down, manage in front with the media, and manage a bullpen and do the basic tactical things that sometimes could undo you, man, you got yourself a star manager at that point. And I don't need him to throw dirt on the umpire. I don't need him to scream and yell. I don't care what his emotions are in that dugout, because you don't know and I don't know what he says behind closed doors, nor should we. Okay, because now the players don't want their dirty laundry aired. They don't want to be aired out in the dugout. Sometimes you and I want that. Sometimes you and I are angry, but that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. So, got to give Louis Rojas good grades there, and I have to agree with Zach Scott. I think it was very interesting to hear what Mark Cuban has to say as another sport, a progressive owner in another sport. What are they looking for in their coach? And there it goes. A lot of that is what you heard Mark Cuban say is what Louis Rojas brings to the table. All right, let's take a quick break. When we return, Pat Ragazzo, Sports Illustrated. We'll talk about the Mets. We'll talk about Louis Rojas. Hey, the Mets made a pretty big splash in the draft. I haven't gotten into that, but we'll get Pat's take on that. That and more right after this. There have been a lot of amazing scenarios during Mets history. Did you know that Mr. Met was fired? Yes, fired for a brief time. Devin Gordon author of the book So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the New York Mets, talked about Mr. Met's short-lived replacement on the Talking Mets podcast.
They actually fired Mr. Met. They fired Mr. Met. Loving father and husband. And replaced him with a mule. A live, actual mule that they named Mettle, M-E-T-T-L-E, because they wanted a symbol of unglamorous grit and determination to be the symbol of the Mets. And they ended up, it turned out, and this only occurred to them later, the demise of Mettle the Mule was brought on, because it turns out that mules need to be fed, and they require care and feeding. And you have to store them in humane facilities. And all of these things cost money. Whereas you can pay Mr. Met 9 to 5.
Listen to this and more at www.talkingmetspodcast.com. We're back, and joining me, first time on the show, Pat Ragazzo at Ragazzo Report on Twitter. He's the Mets beat reporter with Sports Illustrated Fan Nation. Inside the Mets, right, Pat? So you That's also right. know him if you listen, and I know that this will be, you know, rile people up. He's the other half of the Frank the Tank Pod. He does a much better job than I do getting Frank to talk. So, you know, Pat, welcome to the program. Chance to exhale, take a breath here. And I'll be honest, I'm not a big all-star guy anymore. I'll probably peek in the home run derby. I was more into it on Pete Alonso's first year. A little bit of Netflix, catching up with the wife and the family. You know, my wife's like, 4 days, no baseball. Let's take a break here. And I, like I said, the opening to the fans, even for you covering the team and the fans, you got to take that breath and get ready for what will be an interesting second half.
Yeah, for sure. So first off, Mike, thanks so much for having me on. Very excited to be here. And I'm kind of with you with the All-Star Week, kind of just trying to take the time to, you know, catch my breath and kind of get all my ducks in the row, get ready for a second half. But of course, we have Pete Alonso in the home run derby tonight. So I will be, you know, checking in on that sporadically. Probably will be watching him for the most part. We might not get as an exciting performance as we did in his rookie year 2 years ago, where he took home the title, but should be, you know, pretty fun to watch. And then, of course, Jacob deGrom's not participating in the All-Star game tomorrow night. Maybe Taijuan Walker gets in, which could be pretty interesting. But yeah, I'm just excited to be here and kind of talk about the first half and you know, talk about what's coming next. And obviously you mentioned Frank the Tank too. Of course, everyone knows who he is. He's very, very passionate about the Mets and lives and dies basically with every pitch, which is what leads to his negativity, as everybody knows.
Oh, absolutely. I think he's taken Jim Brewer's like video. I actually looked for his rate and I didn't look at the post game of the I was so annoyed by the Pirate game. I was like, I don't need Frank's negativity, but interesting end to the first half. And here's what I would say, you know, and I said in the opening, if you look at everything, the 17 guys on the DL, 7 and 9 of the opening day starters, losing 3 starting pitchers, you're going into 7, 8, 9, the Eichhoffs of the world, McGill, guy that you didn't even have on the radar, worst offense in all of baseball. They went number 30 at some point. I don't know where they are now. And then you have that franchise player adjusting to New York. And look, there was Piazza, there was Beltran. This was as much of a struggle for him as it was for those guys. Not as maybe micro-focus for a variety of reasons, but certainly there. When you look at all that, first place by 4 games in the loss column, you can say, hey, missed opportunity. But I think if I put all that in front of you back at day one, opening day, and said, Pat, this is what's in front of the Mets, and would you sign for this? The old Mike and the Mad Dog, would you sign for this? I think I'd sign for it. I know that sounds crazy because there's so much missed opportunity, but I'd sign for it knowing all those things.
A lot of people are, you know, upset with what happened yesterday. I think the finale was the worst loss of the season. One of the biggest differences with the Mets this year is those meltdown losses that we, you know, have become accustomed to seeing in seasons past had really not happened in the first half. The Mets have been pulling out games that they wouldn't have won. And that's, I think, a huge reason of why this team is so different. But I'm in total agreement that the fact that everyone was just kind of hoping for 500 once the entire, you know, half the roster was injured, more than half the roster, I would say. There was a couple weeks stretch where DeGrom and Taijuan Walker were on the IL, and it was Stroman and Peterson and a struggling Lucchese in the rotation. and, you know, half the lineup was out too. So the fact that the Mets have held on to first place for 9 straight weeks, they're 7 games over 500. Yes, they should be a game better. They should have taken 3 out of 4 from the Pirates yesterday. They're over, you know, they were really out of, their bullpen was taxed, and, you know, they've basically been going with a opener every 5 days, and they had that brutal, you know, 33 and 31 days.
Like
they went 17 and 16. You know, they weren't as hot, but they played better, you know, as of late. I'd say that there's a lot of positives that came out of this. There's a couple things that need to happen in the second half, and, you know, conveniently we have the trade deadline coming up. So I think the Mets definitely need to get another starter in here. It sounds like they're already planning that. You know, whether it's going to be a top of the rotation arm, it doesn't sound like it based off what Zach Scott said to us a couple weeks ago at Citi Field. But Carlos Carrasco seems to be, you know, on his way back. He's starting a rehab assignment this week, which we just found out today. And also, you know, that's not going to stop them. Like in recent years past, as we mentioned, it's not going to stop what they do at the deadline as well. So I think they're going to be better stocked in the rotation at least. So the pitching staff, which is already third best staff ERA in the league, you know, finishing out the first half, it's probably going to improve, which is a positive sign. And then, of course, the offense needs to pick things up in the second half as well.
Pat Ragazzo, Sports Illustrated, joining me, new to the show. Glad to have him on. I think front offices get a little overestimated and a little lionized in today's game. I mean, it's front office. But I have to say, I don't think fans understand, and maybe even some of the writers forget, historically significant what's been going on. New owner November 1st. Couldn't do a darn thing before November 1st. Sandy comes in. You know, he didn't want the job full time in terms of doing the baseball part. He wanted to be more of an overseer of the whole organization. GM comes in. GM leaves. Zach Scott comes in. They have to pivot multiple times. They're building the front office while they're building their roster. And yeah, they got a little lucky for every Bauer situation for Taijuan Walker. You know, it could have been James Paxton instead. They got Kevin Pillar and Jonathan Villar using Steve Cohen's money at the bottom of the market. But between taking analytics and implementing it, whether it be with the shift or the lineup or the bullpen, you have to give them a ton of credit, whether it's luck or product of design. I think they're the real story of the first half, because a lot of times front offices, especially the analytics world, I think get overrated. I think this front office has had a big impact, and you're down there. You hear about it all the time. Am I overstating it? Because, you know, sometimes I get the roll of the eye, but I think they deserve a ton of credit. Maybe in some cases getting the most out of a group of players that, let's face it, could very easily be 500 or below at this point.
Yeah, of course. There also was some front office promotions today. Ian Levin and Brian Alderson, who's the son of team president Sandy Alderson, they both actually got promoted. They were in the pro scouting director roles of amateur, and Alderson was the pro scouting director. They got promoted to assistant GMs today, actually, which is what we were hearing from multiple reports. Those two guys in the pro scouting department, a big part of what they did, they had their hands on, you know, finding those other guys, the Pillars, bringing in the Pillars, the VRs, you know, all these guys who, you know, the Perrazas, they had a big role in bringing those guys in. And yeah, you can't even understate what the front office has been able to do with all these depth pieces. And then, you know, bringing in a Billy McKinney, who, you know, he's cooled off now and maybe come back down to earth a little bit. He did have a big pinch hit RBI single in the night.
He might be gone.
Doubleheader.
He might be gone in a couple of days.
That's right. Cause they're running out of room on the roster with JD Davis's return looming finally. But I mean, in the moment, they lost Conforto for over a month, and they brought in McKinney, and that guy stepped in, and he played very, very well. And it's just a number of things, really, besides, like, you could say, like, Albert Amora was probably one of the lone signings that didn't work out this offseason. And it's not really something that hurt them, but really everybody else has come in and contributed. Jose Peraza has been one of their most clutch hitters. He's bailed them out of a lot of games. Kevin Pillar has basically filled in and been a starter, you know, with them missing Nimmo for 2 months. And other than, you know, getting hit in the face with a pitch and missing 2 weeks, he's been in there basically the whole time, and he's produced for the most part. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned it earlier too, Lindor, was struggling at first. He's picked it up as of late, but he still hasn't gotten like red hot and like been that dominant top of the lineup hitter that could carry your, you know, carry your offense like we saw from Yoenis Cespedes when the Mets got him in 2015. But he's been a lot better. He really has been, you know, he's been solid. He needs to do more given his contract, of course, and given the impact that they expect him to have on the team. But it's just guys kind of now finding their footing. James McCann, I believe, has led all major league catchers in RBI since the beginning of June. He's picked it up after a slow start. He's still kind of inconsistent here and there, but he's been pretty good. He was their second, you know, biggest signing of the offseason to the lineup. McNeil seems like he's starting to come around. And also a big key for this offense in the second half is going to be what Michael Conforto does too, because, you know, the injury derailing Conforto, that 3-run homer he had on Sunday was very promising to see, but now we got to see it kind of carry over because, you know, he had the rough start to the season and then he, you know, he was picking it up and he was starting to hit a lot better. And then he got hurt and missed 6 weeks. And then it was kind of just his season was halted before it really got started. So the Mets have like five all-stars in the past that they have in their lineup out of 8 and of their starters. And, you know, if those guys kind of come together, this is why they expected the offense to be a top unit and not be, you know, ranked in the bottom half in the, not even the bottom half, but
bottom of the league
24. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, guys need to kind of start fulfilling, you know, the roles that they were supposed to, you know, carry this year. And then at the same time, I do think that they're going to bring in another bat too. And I know we keep hearing Donaldson. We keep hearing, you know, maybe pairing him with Berrios. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be maybe like, and I referenced 2015 earlier, maybe like a guy like not obviously Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe are out of the league now, but a hitter maybe like that, like a role player. I know they have VR, they have a couple of guys, but there's something I think that needs to be inserted into this lineup. There's little to minimum room right now, but they definitely need to add another piece, I think, to kind of propel this team to where they need to go.
Makes you wonder when you talk about the offense now, since Nimmo came back, there was a stat yesterday on the broadcast. They've averaged a little over 5 runs a game. That's where you expected them to be. You know, 5 runs a game, top 5 offense in all of baseball. You know, you look at, and I'm just throwing a name out there, Adam Frazier, guy who's a contact guy. You know, you saw him all weekend, you know, might be a nice thing. You know, actually the Pirates had a couple of guys, Rodriguez out of the bullpen. Guy just throws fastballs and strikes. They may need another bullpen arm. And I think I'll start where on the offensive side, the reality is that if you don't go and get, like you said, Donaldson O'Brien at the top of the market, I don't know how much of an impact anybody they can have, you know, will be. And in a lot of ways you have to stop and stay back and say, this offense has a lot of, you know, history. If you look at the back of the old baseball card, or you look at Baseball Reference, you almost have to sit back and let them execute. They don't execute with runners on third and less than 2 outs. They're about 10% below the league average. They don't always have the best approach. Louis Rojas has said that. Hugh Quattlebaum has said that. You even saw it yesterday. I think there was an at-bat, Dom Smith. He had a 3-ball count. He swung at a pitch over his head, hit the ball to the warning track, but with a run on first, you know, that walk, you know, taking that extra walk like they did in that first inning, I think puts more pressure on the opposition, will make them even better. And when they've done that, they've really, you know, broke out against the Yankees and against the Pirates on Friday. So in a lot of ways, I'm even saying to myself, it's about these guys performing. You can't replace 8 hitters. There's no trade. And Chris Bryant in and of himself, other than maybe hedging your bets on Conforto as a free agent, now you have 2 choices at the top of the market to see who you sign. It may be that they have to just survive and go with these guys. And it'd be interesting because Lindor, as you mentioned, you know, he's been a little underwhelming, but if you look at his offense, the last 44, 45 games, he's pretty much who he is. My biggest fear is, you know, it's kind of a 2-part conversation. 1, you may have to live with the offense and hope that they break out and they do better at executing an approach. 2, Lindor may never live up to expectations because I think everybody wants Mike Trout because of the contract. And I think they're not seeing this was not who you were getting. Cleveland reporters told you that. The statistics told you that. And I think at some point the hype is so high, my fear is that he'll never be looked at as a success. So it's an interesting, when you look at the offense, those 2 things, that's a big play here into the second half.
Yeah, it definitely is. And a lot of what we heard about Lindor and the warning signs with him was that he was kind of in a dip for the last year and a half, that I think he was batting around 238 since his the end of his tenure in Cleveland, and they were trying to get rid of him pretty aggressively. But I do think he has made an impact. there's just, he's under such a microscope being here and with everybody. Like, if he doesn't, if he has runners in scoring position and he doesn't come through every time, he's getting booed because he didn't come through that one time. And statistically, that's just not possible for him to come right. through 1,000% of the time, obviously. But I think he's done a good job. He had a big 2-run homer yesterday. He was on base 4 times and 3 hits. I just think the overall numbers, I think people will start coming around to him more. And he even said it himself. He had that big grand slam on Friday night to cap off the 10-run inning in the rout of the Pirates in game one. And he was like, I was just rounding the bases to hear if I was still getting booed, because they constantly right. are still booing me, even though, like,
Bigger impact yeah. than we thought. I don't think that they realize. Look, everybody's gone through it. Never has there been a guy. And part of me was like, hey, do we really have to sign him in spring training? Can't you see what you got? And to a certain degree, imagine if they did that. They might actually get some value, but, you know, the market is the market. It's an emotional decision. And I think that this is a big play, because this is a guy that, as you go down the stretch, especially when September comes, those numbers are going to be brought up, you know, how clutch he is and whatnot. And it may play, you know, since he's been better, the Mets have been better. Since Nemo's been back, the Mets have been better. If they average 5 runs a game, you know, looking at the deadline ahead, getting a Kyle Gibson type of starter, you know, that'll give you innings, you know, depending on the cost there. And I bring up Rodriguez from the Pirates just because I think there's a guy who's a closer who's probably not a closer. He's a closer on a bad team. You bring a guy on like that, it could come in, throw strikes, give you a clean inning. They need more of that, because the Castro, the second tier of this bullpen, when you get from Familia, Castro, Drew Smith, et cetera, is a lot more dicey than the prime A guys. And they played so many close games. In some ways, they're fortunate that the B bullpen guys haven't hurt them. You saw yesterday what could be the future. Could be the future is what you saw yesterday. They can't get the outs they need. Now, they were asking a lot out of those guys, and they asked a lot out of Diaz. But the fact that Diaz had to get you those outs tells you how thin that second tier of the bullpen is. And it's scary. And that's maybe where you talk about deadline. Maybe that's the direction to go, because you may not be able to get it all.
Yeah, I think especially with Carrasco coming back, and I know Scott and, you know, Scott kind of said, like, we can't rely on that. Like, we just have to look like, you know, look at Carrasco and obviously Syndergaard as bonuses at this point. But at the same time, yeah, I think bullpen is, you know, a major, major area that they need to look at and maybe consider, you know, acquiring a nice, you know, arm who they could pitch late in games and rely on, you know, to lock down the games. Because, like I mentioned previously, they have won these games that they wouldn't have won in years past. And that's because the bullpen would be blowing it later. It would be Edwin Diaz who was struggling. But Diaz has been pretty much lights out besides, you know, with the exception of yesterday in the 9th inning. And, you know, the bullpen is surprised too. Bullpen was something I myself and a lot of other people I know thought was going to be a weakness. Seth Lugo had to get the, you know, the elbow surgery, and he was out until June 1st or Memorial Day, whenever it was. But the fact that he was going to have to, you know, he missed 2 months of the season to start the year. You were like, all right, well, like, here we go again. Like, bullpen is going to be a weakness. On paper, it was a weakness going into the season. And they surprised. Right. Familia turned back the clock. Miguel Castro was dominant until the last couple weeks. You know, Edwin Diaz obviously had an all-star caliber first half. So there was just a bunch of things that, you know, you weren't counting on that wound up working out. And that's the reason why the bullpen has been so good. But now, I think I agree with you there that they do need to kind of do something to solidify it. It's good that Lugo's back. Lugo's been, you know, pretty good. Usually he's been like spotless, I think, in years past in the bullpen. Yeah. He hasn't necessarily
little dip, but he's coming back from surgery, so maybe getting some time there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he hasn't, there have been a few outings where, like, he has, you know, he's bent but not broken. Or he, you know, he did give up a homer the other night.
His hard hit rate is up. If you look at Baseball Savant, I think his hard rate rate's a little bit up. There's little tiny things. And again, we don't have the data that these guys, little tiny things that indicate he's not quite himself, but not quite himself is still a pretty darn good reliever over there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, he normally was lights out, like one of the best relievers in the game. And then now he's a very, very good and above average, but like, I'm sure you remember the second to last game of the Cubs series where the Cubs were at Citi Field in mid June. And, you know, if it wasn't for that play at the plate, Lugo would have blown the save.
He would have blown the save.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was really tough getting he got pushed for 2 innings, but he was, and he was running on fumes, and they kind of just asked a lot for him there. But yeah, that's just kind of an example of, like, in years past, he would be, you know, locked down for two innings. Like in 2019, he was their closer every other day because he'd just give you, like, basically he'd go three up, three down in the eighth and ninth inning and no one could hit him. But yeah, I mean, he's obviously a huge key piece too. And getting Miguel Castro back on track, which is, you know, hopefully something they can
tough
do.
One.
Yeah, it is a tough one because you don't really know. He came in and was a guy who always got in trouble with his control. But when he had his command, you know, he obviously has great stuff. But I've asked Rojas a couple times about it in the past week and a half or so about, you know, what are you seeing from Castro? What's going on with him? Are you concerned? And really, it's more so just comes down to the command, which everybody can see. And the fact that his changeup isn't there. And that's a big reason why Castro was so good in the first half until the last few weeks is because he had that changeup working for him. And it's just not there right now.
Luis Rojas, a couple of things here as we get to the back half and wrap up. Luis Rojas, not the first choice. You know, when they were going through the managerial search, I was all about a Buck Showalter, a Joel Girardi. And then Beltran came in. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, kind of a different guy that I never would have expected from his playing days. And then this whole chaotic situation with the sign stealing, they kind of bumble into Rojas. He wasn't a big focus last year in the shortened season. And I think you have to give him a lot of credit. And I know it's hard covering him largely on Zoom, but, you know, you talk about, you know, Zach Scott talked about it in the scrum the other day. He communicates with his players, yet he holds them accountable. I think he does a really good job with you guys in the media because that could be a hornet's nest. The rat raccoon night, I remember watching that. I'm like, oh, here we go. Here we go. And he handled it. He's like, look, not what I would have done. He basically said, not necessarily what I think happened, but what do you want me to tell you guys? It's nonsense, but it's their nonsense. And it's basically how they're handling it. And he's managed his bosses. He's open-minded, like Scott said. And it seems like he's had to have a lot of tough conversations with implementing the shift and analytics and guys bouncing around the lineup, even dropping Lindor a little bit. Never having to really drop him, but drop him a little bit. When you factor that all in, and even his bullpen management, other than I could quibble with the maybe a few things here or there, maybe not bringing in Drew Smith in the second inning yesterday, maybe pushing Familia a little bit too much into two innings or the work, other than some minor things, this is the first time in maybe two decades, maybe since Bobby V was the manager, that I can't sit here and say, wow, what a horribly managed bullpen. When you factor all that, maybe the Mets bumbled their way into a really good manager and a guy that could grow with this team, that grew up through the organization, almost like they're Ron Gardenhire, which is a beautiful thing if that's what it turns out to be.
There's a lot to unpack about Luis Rojas. I think he's learning a lot, which is obviously a great sign with any manager, any coach, is somebody who learns from their mistakes is someone who's going to be a good manager, is someone who's going to improve. And there's room to grow, and I think he's really grown into it this year. He's been saying it too. He's like, I've learned a lot this year. You know, I talk to a lot of people for advice, but also I've learned from my mistakes, and that's pretty evident. He doesn't always have the best day. He's made mistakes. Every manager makes mistakes. Every time they lose, it seems like everybody love to blame him just because they love to, you know, they love to blame the coach or the manager. But honestly, he deserves a lot of credit for holding this team together and helping steer the ship. With all the injuries they had, they could have fallen apart so many times. They've had some tough stretches, and he's held the guys together. He's what they call a player's manager. And, you know, they love him. A lot of guys grew up with him in the organization, but he really gets along with the players. He really gets along with us, with the media. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I know I'm new. This is my rookie year, but he takes the time to talk to all of us individually. Now that we're out on the field, you know, he makes it a habit of talking to us. He knows everyone by first name, calls you by your first name. He's very personable. He's easy to talk to. And he's great in the media. You heard, you know, he was asked recently, how relieved are you that you didn't sign Trevor Bauer? And he answered it, you know, perfectly. He was like, you know what? He's like, I'm just glad we have Taiwan Walker. And there's been a lot of instances like that where not only is he great in the media, which is a necessity in this market, but, you know, he's learning in the dugout and he's, you know, he's leading a first place team, you know, that's dealt with a ton of adversity this year. And if I were to give him a grade right now, which he wouldn't give himself a grade yesterday when asked about it, obviously, but he deserves an A, I would say, for the first half by far.
Wow. And he's holding, you make a key point. My impression is, yes, he's a player's manager. Yes, he communicates. Yes, he grew up. But they're not taking advantage of him. I wouldn't cross him. There's a part of Luis Rojas that a sternness that you see, and I think you guys have seen it a little bit over Zoom more so, when you know he's annoyed. And I don't think the players are running the inmates aren't running the asylum, for lack of a better word. And that's key, because sometimes there's that player manager. And I was recently reading Andy Martino's book about the sign stealing. And one of the key quotes that I took away was from AJ Hinch, where leadership is sometimes how much you tolerate. And he tolerated too much. Yeah. And I never thought of it that way, because now today you can't be Bill Parcells. You can't be Pat Riley. Riley would even tell you that. You know, he said that. You have to be a hybrid. And even Mark Cuban was recently talking about that with them hiring Jason Kidd. You need to communicate and care. You got to care about these guys. But you can't do it to the point where you become their therapist and not their leader. And I think Louis had that kind of balance from what it sounds like what you're talking about.
Yeah, he has. And he also is super honest, too, about things. Like, he will be the first one to tell you that he doesn't like how Lindor enjoys to, you know, utilize the sack bunt. Lindor has like 5 sack bunts this season. And Louis has told us, because he gets asked about it every time, but, you know, it helped manufacture a run in the Brewers series, you know, when the team was kind of struggling to score. And, you know, it helped them out in that game. I believe it led to a win. It helped lead to a win. But I think actually that was in the game where Brandon Woodruff was, you know, kind of dominating, and Lindor laid down a sack bunt and they wound up scoring, you know, and tying the game. And then later they got to Woodruff and won the game. But yeah, he said, he was like, I've had those conversations with Lindor. Like, I want you swinging the bat there. Like, you're our best hitter. Right. We want you swinging. We don't want you bunting. But Lindor is a very team first guy, which is another good reason. Like, you hear about his leadership, you hear about, you know, the type of player he is. Lindor is about the team. He's not like, oh, I don't, you know, I don't lay down sack bunts because I'm the superstar. Like, no, he wants to help the team in any way possible. And that's why he lays down the sack bunts sometimes, you know, when needed. But yeah, Louis's honest. It's not like Louis in years past, like, you'd hear Mickey Callaway kind of, you know, put lipstick on a pig basically in every situation of, oh, Diaz blew what, his 5th save in 6 attempts. Oh, he looks really good out there. Like, right. No, like, Louis will, you know, be straightforward to you. And that's another reason why I think he's, you know, he is long for this town, is because, you know, you got to be honest like that. Like, everyone listening, the fans, the media, we're not stupid. Like, right. Just be straight up with us. When a guy is struggling or when something happens, like, just be honest.
Before we wrap up, Kumar Rocker, what's interesting about the Mets draft, it's still going on as we speak, is they've taken a ton of pitchers. Makes me wonder, one, they had another high-end arm coming into the organization. Maybe that allows them to move a high-end arm, a JT Ginn. I know Matthew Allen's hurt, but that's never stopped teams from acquiring in the past. Interesting to see a different Mets philosophy, the money, the flexibility. It's not just about going out and signing, you know, a $40 million a year player. I think it's about knowing what you can spend, being able to be flexible, being able to take a guy with a 10th pick, which, look, he dropped at number 10. If it's just money, great. Maybe there's something else. Obviously, nobody's as good as anybody projects them to be. We tend to overrate this stuff. But it's interesting because today might actually help the Mets, not necessarily in terms of players right now, but it'd be interesting, this draft will make them feel confident in dealing some more of the upper echelon in the system, because that's been we don't want to trade any top prospects. Well, guess what? You might not even get a Kyle Gibson, who has a year left on his contract without giving up something. There's going to be pain. I know that Mets fans don't want to hear that after all the years where they had to dump players. But I'd be curious your thoughts. You know, an interesting Sunday night after a bad loss, big-time player. Very rarely do you see universal praise for the Mets in the national media. And now, can this have impact on the trade deadline in just a couple of weeks?
That's definitely an interesting way of looking at it, actually. First off, I mean, Kumar Rocker was basically the second biggest name for a pitcher in college baseball right now, next to his teammate Jack Leiter at Vanderbilt.
Would have been a great story, Jack Leiter on the Mets, but not going
to
happen.
Yeah, I know. No one expected that to happen. But, I mean, no one expected Rocker to, you know, fall to the Mets. And from what I've heard, it's, you know, it had to do with his contract demands, which he got a $6 million signing bonus from the Mets today. And also the fact that there was a, you know, a slight dip in his velocity. I believe he was down to like 91 miles per hour this year. But this kid really is a bona fide stud and has, you know, top of the rotation type potential. And we could probably see him in maybe a year, year and a half up. He's not going to be in the minors for very long. He just had a, you know, a pretty long and decent career at Vanderbilt. So I think that this was a really, really good pick and definitely worth the money and could really pay off for the Mets. And it does, like you said, it does give them more flexibility. Now, if they want to trade a JT Ginn, who's coming off Tommy John surgery anyway, you know, maybe they want to, you know, if the price is right, they could package him in a trade. from what it sounded like, Scott was saying that they don't want to give up any of their top prospects this year. But you know good and well, and so do I, that, you know, when teams have good farm systems, and the Mets farm system now has been rebuilt again, it looks, you know, it's pretty attractive now. They got some good young players. That's when the opposing teams, when you're making calls, opposing teams are calling you, they're asking for some of your top guys. They're trying to get you to overpay. And it just kind of comes down to what, you know, where they value, you know, whatever target they have versus the prospect they have. And, you know, what's fair and what's not, it just kind of makes it tougher. Like, even with the Yankees for years, when the Yankees were stacked in the farm system with the trades they made, they overvalued their prospects, which is also something the Mets need to be careful of. And now they're kind of stuck in a situation where it's like, should we buy, should we sell? They're not really set up well for the future. But yeah, at the same time, like, the Mets, like, you can't overpay, and then you can't, you know, you still got to kind of, you know, walk a fine line there, but it definitely gives them more flexibility with a guy like Rocker, who could be up in a year and a half. Maybe he could have either I'd say, honestly, like, at the rate Ginn's going, especially with the Tommy John rehab and everything, Rocker probably will make his debut before him, is what it sounds like. So those two are interesting, and I guess something to keep an eye on, and the fact that the Mets are replenishing their pitching in the farm system. But
Futures game, Alvarez, Brett Beatty, and Binghamton. It's a long ways away from 2018 and three GMs, and nobody wants to give you anything for Familia. So, Pat, other than, you know, Sports Illustrated, obviously, at Regazzo Report on Twitter, Pat does great work. You know, we have only the best of the best here on this show, and you follow him. He's at the ballpark. You know, he's doing his thing. What else you got going on? You got Frank the Tank. You know, Frank made a very big impression on this show. It was the hardest interview I've ever had. I told people, I don't know what I did. I usually could always get something out of somebody. And Frank was just like very melancholy. I got him on the wrong day. So what do you got coming up? You got the Frank the Tank, Sports Illustrated. What else you got coming up?
Yeah, of course. So again, trying to, you know, maybe cut back a little bit in the next few days with the All-Star break, kind of trying to enjoy, you know, and get rested up before we dive into the second half. Cause you know, it's a day in and day out grind, but yeah, I'm probably just going to do some stuff this week, you know, maybe a little related to the home run derby, looking ahead to the second half for the Mets and kind of their biggest needs. Got Frank the Tank pod. We're recording with Frank, presented by Feltman's Coney Island Hot Dogs.
Now you're making me hungry. I haven't had dinner yet. Now you're making me hungry.
Oh, well, you got to try Feltman's. Feltman's are best hot dogs in the business. But we have we're recording on Wednesday, so that episode will drop Thursday. And I also do contribute to Inside the Pinstripes, which is another Sports Illustrated site for the Yankees. I contribute a few articles a week with them. So, you know, kind of just bouncing out between, you know, my everyday job of being on the Mets beat. So, just lots of baseball, hopefully a little rest, and and looking forward to going through and diving into the second half.
Pat, be well. You spent a generous amount of time. Loved it. Let's do this again, my friend. All righty?
Of course. Thanks so much, Mike. Right. It was a blast, and thanks for having me on.
And that's Pat Regazzo. You can check him out at Regazzo Report, Sports Illustrated, Mets beat reporter, Frank the Tank pod. Listen. You got to laugh at Frank. I know you guys didn't like him. I still think he's funny. You know, he balances out the positive and the negative, right? You have a lot of positive around the Mets Twitter sphere. Frank will always bring you back down. All right, let's take a quick break, wrap up. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. Doc Gooden's first 2 years in the big leagues were some of the best in the history of baseball. How did that impact him going forward? He discussed this with me on the Talking Mets podcast.
You know, normally you have those type of years, maybe like year five, year six, once you get like 28, 29 years old. Mine happened in 1920, my first 2 years. I remember a game in 86 where I pitched a shutout, but I only had three strikeouts. The first question was, what happened? You only had three strikeouts. And, you know, you'll say the political correct words. You'll say, oh, I'm not worrying about that. I just want to win. It's for the team. But inside, now, that hit a nerve where you feel like my next start, I got to pitch 9 innings, I got to pitch a shutout, I got to get 10 strikeouts. And I lost some fun that I was having in the game because of that, because of expectations, where it became like the media expectation, the fan expectation. Then it became my expectations, what I felt that anything I did, like I couldn't match 85 no matter what I did. But in my mind, if I didn't get the 10 strikeouts, whatever, it wasn't the same. It wasn't just a win. And I wasn't having as much fun as I should have had. And that's one of the things I regret looking back at my career now, where I allowed things, what, you know, whether it's the media, the fans, or myself at that point, getting into my own head, allowing that me to lose the fun. Because it should be a privilege playing Major League Baseball, and you're still winning games, you're still pitching great. Obviously, it's not 85, but unfortunately, I had my career year, my second year, or you say my first year, and you're never going to match that again.
Listen to this and more at www.talkingmetspodcast.com. I thought Pat was a great guest. I thought we had a lot of good conversation. You heard his take. You know, Pat does some really good work. You can check him out over at Sports Illustrated's the Ragazzo Report, at Ragazzo Report on Twitter. You know, the Sports Illustrated Mets coverage inside the Mets. So a new voice that I highly recommend that you guys follow, and a new guy that we could get on the show and hopefully interact with as the season goes on. As far as what I have to wrap up, I've kept you guys well over the hour here. Hopefully gives you some things to chomp on throughout the All-Star break. One other thing I just wanted to leave you on is I saw some chatter over the weekend about Anthony Rucker on the broadcast. And I made a comment that I think some people took, you know, not so great, that, you know, in all due respect, it might be time for the Mets to incorporate some more contemporary voices, as the more that we go down the road with Gary, Keith, and Ron, the more that they're getting dated a little bit. You know, Keith and Ron haven't played. I mean, Keith retired in 1990. You're looking at well over 30 years. Ron, a few years later. It's been, you know, about 25 years. And not that they have bad baseball knowledge, but there's only so many stories you could tell in the booth. You know, we've heard quite a few of them. They have great chemistry. I love Keith's Phil Rizzuto shtick. I mean, even Keith got hurt this first half, and he was on the injured list by falling off. I guess it was his hot tub trying to trim a rose bush or something. I don't know. But, and I said, you know, the thing about Rucker is at least there's some contemporary embracing of the modern game. He played with some of the guys. You know, he had stories about DeGrom and catching DeGrom in Vegas and being with the 2015 team. And there's a value to that, I think. And I think it's important for the Mets, because even Todd Zeal, I mean, Todd Zeal hasn't played in you know, probably 15, you know, 20 years. You know, I think he retired somewhere 2005, 2006, somewhere around there. So, you know, I know people got crazy about it. I'm not advocating to break up Gary, Keith, and Ron. They're not going to announce forever. You know, Keith is going to want to eventually retire. You know, Ron's got his sights on a national broadcast. It's a good paycheck, but it's work. It's travel. And I thought starting to incorporate some more contemporary voices like a Rucker, who I think have a connection to the Mets, I think that's important, and have some character, you know, is something the Mets should continue to try to do. And I was all for it. That doesn't mean you don't, you know, have any more Gary, Keith, and Ron, but I thought it was interesting how people get crazy. And I've always said, been blessed that growing up, some of the best broadcasters in the history of baseball and in the history of all sports, with Marv Albert recently retiring, and I growing up listening to him on Knicks broadcasts, I feel very lucky. I feel very lucky that the small piece that I do in this media world, I can say these are voices that were big for me, especially someone who listened to a lot of sports on the radio up until I was about 16 years old, not having cable when I grew up. Just I thought I had an interesting perspective. So I wanted to throw that out there. I think it's nice that the Mets are starting to incorporate maybe a more contemporary voice. I think they should do more of that. Obviously, you need to have the play-by-play chops. Not easy. He's more of a color commentator, a Rucker. And it's not putting you in the booth on a live broadcast, especially doing those intros. Not easy. I give him a ton of credit. He needs a little bit of work, maybe a little bit robotic at times, but some interesting takes and contemporary takes. And I think that's important as we get further and further away from the 86 Mets and the 80s Mets. I think these other voices can provide some kind of balancing act to the folksy type of Phil Rizzuto, Ron, Gary, the Mets fan kind of shtick that they've had going on. Once in a while, a new voice is not bad. And that's all I said. So wanted to end on that note. Want to thank Pat Ragazzo for joining me today. Of course, you can check him out at Ragazzo Report on Twitter. Check him out on Sports Illustrated and Inside the Mets. Of course, you can check me out all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy your All-Star break. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast in the second half. We'll start off the second half with a new, fresh slate. Till then, take care, everybody.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.